Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today I'm really excited to have this show because I have colleagues on, who, both of whom I respect greatly, and both have been on the front line and making a difference. We've taken a little bit of hiatus last year talking about the healthcare system, but now with everything that's going on, we need to circle back to what is important for patients to know, and specifically for doctors as well to know. This system, I'm sure I'm not speaking alone. My colleagues feel the same way, that it's a disaster. And if you don't have the ability to know what you do and want to be an advocate for your patient, you're going to get lost in the system. Even if you want to take care of your patient, you're being thwarted. And today I'm joined by two colleagues, Dr. Niran Al-Agba and Dr. Rebecca Bernard. And both are practicing physicians. Dr. Al-Agba is a pediatrician who practices in Washington State. And Dr. Bernard is a family medicine doctor in a direct primary care practice who practices in Florida. And these are people who've been on the front line, who don't work for hospitals or not employed by hospitals, who believe in the Hippocratic Oath, like I do, and who always have wanted the best for their patients and have decided to peek under the cover, because it's like, if you try to do it the right way, you keep hitting brick walls. And you guys were smart enough and, I think, brave enough to figure out why. So today we're going to talk about something that no one ever talks about, and that's the allied healthcare professionals that work along with doctors, or I should say, are trying to work alongside doctors as if they're the same as we are. And that's the nurse practitioner. And they have written a book called Patients at Risk: The Rise of the Nurse Practitioner and Physician Assistant in Healthcare. And it's a timely book. You can get it on Amazon. And we're going to dig deeper so you can figure out, as a patient and as a loved one of a patient, what you need to do to protect yourself. So Niran and Rebecca, thank you so much for joining me. I know you're busy and I really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us. We're happy to be here.
Well, let's give folks, I gave them a little bit of your bio, but please, Niran, tell us how you started the process. I know you have your own practice with your dad, right? Is he still practicing?
No, he passed away in the fall of 2017.
And I'm so sorry. My condolences.
Thank you. Thank you. He would be proud of this effort, though, I think. He really was upset as non-physicians kind of came in and took over healthcare. And I know it was something that he really felt strongly about. So I think he's probably happy with what I've done wherever he is. I joined him in practice after finishing my residency. And I've always been self-employed. I have been solo for a long period of time. And actually, I should just start off by saying I recently added, in the last year and a half, a pediatric nurse practitioner, and we work together. I'm in an independent practice state, technically, but what's been interesting is to see practice through her eyes, as she has finished actually a brick and mortar school and been an experienced nurse for 10 years before going back to school. And it has done sort of what I think is the right way to go back and expand your scope as a nurse. And it's a great pleasure working with her. And so when people say that we are profiting off of this book by holding people away from non-physicians or getting in the middle of it or insulting that profession, that's not really true. I think by now most people have seemed to realize, and if you've read the book, you realize that we're all about patient safety.
I think that's the key. It's all of this territory marking. And, you know, the funny thing is, it's projection, because I find it's the nursing profession that is more, has more animus towards doctors than vice versa. I mean, from your perspective, Rebecca, what do you think? I know that you're in direct primary care, so I know you're solo and you've gone on to price transparency and having the patient be, and you know, a partner in their care.
Yeah, I think that was one of the things that has that surprised Naran and I so much as we were going through this process, was to realize how much pushback we were getting from many entities. And I want to thank you and applaud you for taking on this subject, because I have to tell you that many of our colleagues are really terrified to even discuss this issue. There's a lot of political correctness. There's a lot of fear. Any physician that works for a hospital or in an academic center, if they even speak out about these issues, even to say something as simple as a physician and a nurse practitioner are not the same, they can be fired, and they have been fired. So this is why we come back to your point of owning yourself and not being employed by or controlled by any organizations is so important for physicians. And I know it's not easy if you work in a specialty where you require hospitals or surgical centers, but if there's any way to own yourself as a physician, it's so critical.
I think you're absolutely right. And I, you know, let's frame the conversation. This is not about bashing anybody, nurses, nurse practitioners, physician assistants. I'm looking at your bio, and your mom and dad were registered nurses, were they not?
Yes, they were. They both were. And my mother worked in a nursing home, and my father is an emergency room nurse. So nurses are very near and dear to me. In fact, one of the concerns we have about nurse practitioner and physician assistant profession is that they're actually decreasing the number of registered nurses that are working as bedside nurses, and we really need our nurses.
Oh, I can't. I've had a show with nurses on that topic. And when I was in medical school, it was the nurses who I learned from and as a resident, because they had seen it all, done it all, and they were the ones that we actually looked to as residents to help us, to help guide us. So I have all, you know, the utmost respect for the profession. But you guys have actually uncovered something that we don't know. Things have changed. You talk about brick and mortar versus online nursing programs. What's the difference? Because I think that's a really crucial point that people really need to understand.
Well, so the difference is really phenomenal, actually. Originally, when nurse practitioners would go back to school to what we'd call a brick and mortar school, that means an actual institution where you attend classes in person. And back when this profession, as it was starting and the education was growing at different institutions, you would need to be an experienced nurse. So you would go out into practice as an RN in maybe 5-10 years, and then you would reapply and go to nurse practitioner school. And what's interesting about most of the brick and mortar schools is they actually find you preceptors. So for example, the nurse practitioner I work with now, who went to a brick and mortar school, she has agreed to host a student as a preceptor through that school. So she's on the faculty of that, and then they assign her a student. So she's not answering these requests by students. She and the school have an agreement. And that's, of course, how medical students are trained. The faculty at the medical school, some of us, I'm on faculty at the University of Washington, you know, we will get students that are sent out to us, or I work with our local residency program. So what's different is you have more standardization, you have a more regular curriculum, and over time, you know, those students do well. And actually, the nurse practitioner I work with likes to say she applied twice. She didn't get in the first time. There's no 100% acceptance rate at the University of Washington in the pediatric nurse practitioner school. And she really talks about why she wanted to go there, because she knows it's a difficult thing to get into, and she knows it's a rigorous education. And I'll tell you what, it shows in our office. And so the opposite is what we call these diploma mills, where it's 100% acceptance rate. You do not have to have nursing experience. And you find your own preceptors, and there's no standardization whatsoever. And that's really the broad variation of the two different institutions or possibilities for someone getting an education as a nurse practitioner.
And I think one of the other new phenomenon is this concept called direct entry programs. And the challenge with this is that you're taking people who have no nursing background whatsoever. They don't have to have a bachelor's in nursing. They can have a bachelor's degree in any subject, art, economics, and apply and be accepted into a nurse practitioner program where in 2 years, they gain their nursing degree, diploma, and their nurse practitioner license simultaneously. They call it seamlessly. And so they can come out from these programs and begin practicing as a nurse practitioner without ever working a day as a nurse.
That's actually quite frightening because it's a practice. You have to touch people. You have to, it's not all book learning. That's why we have to do residencies for years on end so that we can actually learn to, you know, I guess, put into practice what we've learned from a book perspective. But I can't imagine going on. It's like leaving medical school and going on your own with no oversight. It just doesn't even make sense. On that note, let's take our first break and come back. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Alagba and Dr. Bernard, two physicians who have taken the time and the care to help all of us, frankly. This is not, and it's not about, you know, having your territory. It's about patient care. We all took an oath to be advocates for our patient, to take the best care of them that we possibly can. And this system is trying to remove doctors. I mean, under the Affordable Care Act, I remember reading whole sections about how they're going to give money for training for nursing aides and nursing practitioners. And the money they gave to doctors were for people who were talking about hospice and palliative care. So it was really not getting extra seats for doctor training. So there seems to have been a decision made to change the workforce of the healthcare system. And I always say, follow the money. So if doctors are the top of this chain in terms of paying out our salaries, and the nurses and the physician assistants, I assume that they don't cost as much. Is that fair to assume?
You know, that's always been the case traditionally. And you're 100% right when you say that there's been a governmental effort to raise up these non-physician practitioners. Both professions were created in 1965, and they were both actually created by physicians with the idea of being able to send medical care into underserved areas and really to act as physician extenders. But the government really liked this idea. And within 20 years, they had given $100 million to fund nurse practitioner training programs and physician assistant programs. They passed the Rural Health Care Act in 1977, which mandated that half of all of the medical practitioners working at rural health clinics had to be physician assistant or nurse practitioner. So there's been a real effort, I think, on the government, and look at the Veterans Administration as another example, to staff with non-physicians. And traditionally, these practitioners did make lower salaries than physicians, but the tide is turning and there's a real effort to something called pay parity. And it's actually one of the strategic goals of the American Association of Nurse Practitioners for them to be paid the same as physicians. And actually in the state of Oregon, the law has already passed that mandates insurance companies and government payers pay PAs and NPs the exact same as they would a physician.
That's pretty shocking, especially when you talk about the time. Neuron, you were speaking before the break about the online learning, but let's talk about the hours of training. There's a significant difference, isn't there, between what a nurse, the time it takes to train for nursing versus an average physician training, isn't there?
Yes, there is. We've talked a lot about how in medical school, by the time we come out, we have about 6,000 hours of clinical experience. And then obviously in residency, we obtain another 11,000 or more. And actually, Rebecca and I were both under the old system. And so, you know, before the residency hours were cut, where we were taking call every third night and, you know, easily doing longer shifts than the 24 hours, often 36 or more. So again, when we came out of our education and training, we had 20,000 hours of clinical experience. And most schools require 500 to most nurse practitioner schools require 500 to 1,000 clinical experience hours. And again, these are with unregulated preceptors. And one example is a nurse practitioner in my home area who is against doing immunizations. And she calls herself a pediatrician. And she has a kind of a direct primary care practice now. And she essentially doesn't recommend people do any immunizations at all. And there are students from online schools that are being sent to precept with this individual. And the shame is, not only is it not a service to our community, but it's also a disservice to that student. But these are unregulated situations that, clinical situations that are training these nurse practitioners, and there's no oversight. And so that's really the big concern, is that there's really no graduate medical, you know, ACGME type place, which is of course the graduate medical education organization that oversees a lot of what goes on in residency programs. That doesn't exist for nurse practitioners or PAs.
How is that even? I mean, we are regulated to the nines. I mean, you've got everybody coming at you to recertify and maintenance certification. These guys don't have anything like that?
Well, they do have accreditation organizations. They're just extremely lax in what they do. And when they finally do get around to sanctioning programs that are poor, which they have been doing recently, there were two different programs, one that's under investigation and one that actually has been sanctioned. They don't do anything about the people who graduated from these programs. So they essentially saying these programs are inadequate, but if you graduated from them already, that's fine. Just go ahead and keep treating patients. That makes no sense to me.
No, it doesn't. It's not patient safety either.
Exactly. So just to continue on that same subject, a lot of what's happened, and when we go back even thinking about the Affordable Care Act and a lot of the lobbying and a lot of the government investment, a lot of it has been sort of, I hate to say it, but a little bit of a snow job. And the reason I say that is when we started this book, we started looking at the details of the studies. And, you know, many of the American Academy of Nurse Practitioners and some of the organizations will say 5 decades of research shows that PAs and nurse practitioners provide equivalent safe care as physicians. And if you're a legislator or a lawmaker who's not involved in the healthcare system, that sounds like a golden opportunity. You know, mm-hmm. There's far less education, it's far less expensive, it's less time. And they can go out and do everything doctors do. It sounds just really like too good to be true. And in reality, as we started reviewing these studies, we realized that these studies that in the Cochrane Library, all of the randomized controlled trials that are on many of the nursing, the governing organizations' websites, while they tout this equivalent care, they are correct. However, every one of those studies has physician supervision. Every single one of them. We could not find a single randomized controlled trial that did not have physicians supervising the nurse practitioners or the PAs. And to us, that is the piece that has been missed by everyone in the government, everybody in healthcare, even doctors themselves, I don't think realized that this is how we've gotten equivalent care, not mm-hmm. without physician supervision. And to me, that's the whole point of this book.
Yeah, because these organizations are so good at, they say the same mantra over and over again. We know they're what they say, 5 decades of research, and they have these kind of statements. They've said it to us so many times and so convincingly that we've believed it. And in fact, in the beginning of writing this book, what I was doing is more trying to tease apart the studies to see if there were any flaws in them. But then we suddenly had this epiphany. The studies were well done. They are good studies, but they always fail to tell the reader, and sometimes they even deceive the reader. We actually discussed this in one of our podcasts. We found that while the authors claim that the nurse practitioners were independent, when you actually dig really deep, you find out that they were under supervision. They worked closely with physicians. They were trained by physicians, and they had additional training to be able to participate in the study. So we really feel that there is a lot of deception out there, and that there's been an effort made to hide the fact that every study ever done on nurse practitioner care has involved physician supervision.
That's a big thing, honestly. I mean, that's a big thing to just admit. I mean, it's fraud, if you really want to be honest about it. But let's look at the corollary of this, or the other side. Who are these physicians that take on, let me ask a different way. If they are not overseen by a physician, who holds the liability? Who's getting malpractice? Who's getting sued with this? Because I think if you want to be equal, then they have to have that just like we do.
What a great question. And I have a friend who helped me pull the legal research from a website called Westlaw. And it generally has all of the cases throughout the country that you can search on. It's essentially like a Google for legal cases. And so I started going back and looking over probably the last 25, 30 years at cases where nurse practitioners were sued for either wrongful death or malpractice. And what you find is there's a number of doctrines, but there's the captain of the ship doctrine, where no matter matter what, the physician is liable. There's also this issue of what constitutes nurse practitioner care versus physician care. And the issue is, just because legislators pass laws doesn't mean that the legal organizations or the justice system has caught up with that. And so there is a number of cases where different things were missed. However, if they could not find, so if a nurse practitioner is being sued, there was a case of meningitis, for example, where she just never gave the child immunizations and the child died of pneumococcal meningitis. And what's interesting is they could not find a nurse practitioner who would testify saying that, that the standard of care should be to do immunizations. And as a result, the nurse practitioner faced no liability for the death of that child.
Right. We see that in case law. It's been shown over and over again in which the jury was specifically instructed to not hold the nurse to the same standard of care as that of a physician. And we have so many documentation of so much documentation of that in our book. And it's really another shocking aspect that patients don't know, that they may not get justice in the event of a medical malpractice case. Now, traditionally, malpractice has been low for nurse practitioners and physician assistants, because traditionally they have been under the direction of a physician. And of course, the physician is the one that holds the ultimate responsibility. Only in the last 10 or 20 years, are we seeing more and more independent practice by nurse practitioners? My guess is eventually the legal system is going to have to figure this out and start to address it. But in the meantime, we don't know if patients are going to get justice if they're mistreated by a non-physician.
Wow. I mean, the irony of this is kind of, it's staggering, right? So let's just say they get their wish and they're able to be paid on par with physicians. Well, they're kind of shooting themselves in the foot, because the whole purpose of hiring them and putting them on the front line is because they're cheaper. So it's almost got like a diminishing return on it. And yeah, when the lawyers figure out they're making just as much as doctors, they're going to actually start coming for them too. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah. And I think a lot of nurse practitioners and physician assistants recognize that too. And we have received many emails and many supportive messages from non-physician practitioners telling us, we do not like what is happening. We disagree with our organization. We think this is a terrible idea. And I think they see what could happen. And many that have been in the profession for years see the changes and they're very worried about it. But their organizations are pushing this, and to the point where at the American Association of Nurse Practitioners conference in 2019, they ended the conference with a slideshow that said, sometimes the strongest voice is silent, and it had a smiley face with a zipper over its mouth. And the point that they were telling the audience was that if you're opposed to our agenda of full practice authority, you need to zip your lip. You need to stay quiet. And nurse practitioners, in many cases, are terrified to speak out. When they do, they're cyber bullied. We've had some discuss this openly with us, and they face a lot of criticism from their peers.
Wow. We're going to come right back and then pick that thought up. You're listening to Living the Solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Niran El-Agba and Dr. Rebecca Bernard, the authors of Patients at Risk, The Rise of the Nurse Practitioner and Physician Assistant in Healthcare. I'm sorry to cut you off before the break, but I mean, I'm just shocked that that there's like this, it's a cabal, right? It's the people who are in power puppet mastering everybody underneath them, whether they like it or not. So who stands to gain with this?
And that's the question I am so glad you asked, because when you talk about following the money, the real answer is the more hospitals that hire non-physicians to fill the role of a physician, they benefit twice. So they're sort of doing double dipping in a nutshell. They are not only paying the practitioner temporarily, depending on what the laws do, temporarily less than they pay physicians, but we've found in most studies, nurse practitioners and PAs do more studies. They cost the system more per patient. It takes them more in labor and efforts, clinic visits, follow-up, things like that, to accomplish the same thing that a physician accomplishes in less time. And so what the hospital is doing is benefiting on the other end from increased studies. So we found imaging, non-physicians order imaging studies 440% more often than physicians do. Well, who's pocketing that money when the nurse practitioner orders the extra x-rays or the CTs or the MRIs that maybe a physician wouldn't? Well, the hospital's profiting. So not only are they paying the workforce less, they're generating more care. And so costs are going to continue rising across the country.
That's an excellent point. And from, I can speak to it from an ENT perspective. When I've been on call in the ER, you know, a peritonsillar abscess is a clinical examination or a diagnosis. You can see it. And every time there's a CT scan, you don't need a CT for that. Just call the consult. I mean, the whole system is just based on, like you said, redundancy, as many tests as you can perform. And ultimately, especially in the hospital setting, which is a real turnoff to me now, you are on the hook for all the bad decisions that came before you. Because when they call that consult, the ball's in your court. So everything that came before, the bad diagnosis, the long, you know, the misdiagnosis, that's all on you as a physician. And I personally have no interest in putting my career at stake for somebody else's mistakes. I don't even want to do locums anymore, for example, because of things like this. And the patients suffer. So instead of getting a consult from a specialist, let's say, or a surgeon, a surgery, it all gets delayed or not at all. Or my favorite, and I'm sorry, I just want to give you this one example. Patient was in a car accident, had a complex laceration of their ear. They didn't take care of it in the ER. They told him to go take care of it as an outpatient. So I saw the guy like a week later. What kind of standard of care is that? It's unbelievable. Mm. So, I mean, from your standpoint, has any stories that you can think of that you've been affected by?
Oh, there's so many. I mean, I think both of us, and you're right about digging ourselves out. What frustrates me is, you know, every time we get to be the third or fourth person in line seeing the patient for whatever reason, you know, we're digging ourselves out. And probably the one that was the most prominent to me is I had a child that was went into the two different urgent cares in a nutshell and had been diagnosed with a urinary tract infection and then was throwing up and kept getting worse. And they'd gone back and forth a number of times. And finally the mom came in, and I'll never forget when I walked in the room, her arms were crossed in front of her chest. And I had seen this child before, just not for this acute visit. And mm-hmm. her arms were crossed in front of her chest. She looked angry. And she said, well, now she's got this rash on her buttocks and her legs, and I'm just done. I'm just tired of this. It can't be what everybody's saying, and I want to know what it is. And of course, I thought, well, gosh, it's a rash on her lower extremities. It's got to be Henoch, Schönlein purpura. So I said, well, let's have you take down your pants. And they were palpable purpura, which would be purple spots that when you close your eyes, you can feel when you run your hand over the leg. And I looked up at her and I said, this is Henoch, Schönlein purpura. And her mouth was on the floor. And she said, I don't understand why this has taken so many days to figure out. And I said, you know, I always try to do this tap dance. Like, I'm sorry, you probably didn't see a physician and you certainly didn't see a pediatrician, because every pediatrician would know this diagnosis blindfolded. And again, it's this idea. She ended up calling her husband. So I waited to explain the disease process to them once the husband left work to come and, you know, hear it, because they both really just wanted to know what was going on. And I remember thinking, you know, this kid had been seen, you know, 2, 3, 4 times in an urgent care for probably 5 times the price. And they were on state insurance. And so again, that's billing the government hundreds of, potentially thousands of dollars. And my visit was like $100. And she ultimately ended up hospitalized that weekend because these kids can get sick, but at least we had a diagnosis.
Well, you know, this is exactly the anecdotes that we tell each other that Dr. George has seen, Dr. Al-Ajwa has seen, that I've seen. This is actually the impetus for us writing this book. Naran and I were both in a group called Physicians for Patient Protection, and it started as a Facebook group where doctors were just sharing the experiences that they were having, the things that they were seeing, and the concerns that they had. And I think once your eyes are open to it, you can't unsee it. But really, until I was hearing these stories from my colleagues, I didn't realize how egregious these problems were, how much this problem was growing, and the fact that no one seemed to be doing anything about it, at least no one in authority. If anything, the pressure's increasing on physicians to, you know, quote, collaborate or, you know, supervise or just refer to non-physician practitioners. And again, if you say anything that is not of the utmost complimentary nature, then you are slandered. You're considered a bad person, a bad doctor. It's really hard to speak out. And this is why, one of the reasons why we've written this book, because we want other doctors to be aware of what's going on, to know that this is not just an isolated thing that they've seen. It's happening across the country, and we really need to recognize it and address it.
Well, there's so much money that's behind this movement, these lobbyists, these people who, professionals, can go and paint a rosy picture. And, you know, the people in the government have no clue. They're like removed from reality. But if you can make them think that they're going to look good, they'll go ahead and do it. But where's the other side? Is there any, I mean, the AMA seems to be completely toothless in this. I haven't heard them say a thing about how doctors and by extension, patients are in the dark. Where's transparency? There should be something where if you walk in, I've heard these stories where people come in the hospital and people come in with a white coat. They might call themselves doctor. They might not identify themselves at all. And the patient has no idea who's taking care of them. How can we get the patients to be more active in asking for, who are you? What are your credentials? I have no problem with telling them. I love ask me, but patients need to do that, don't they?
I think that's the 100% the key. I think the AMA has been focused on the legislative aspects, and you know, so have we in our group. But what I'm realizing is that we're not getting very far with legislators for the exact reasons that you've just said. It's interesting because politicians like Schwarzenegger and Clinton, they both passed laws in their states and in the country to allow a nurse anesthetist to take care of patients without anesthesiologist supervision. But yet both of those individuals, when they needed surgery, they were really quick to have a physician anesthesiologist supervising their care. So it's sometimes it's, you know, it's good enough for the masses, but it's not good enough for them. So what I say is that patients should receive the same level of care as the politicians or vice versa. And so I'm a little tired of going to legislators and not getting anywhere. I want to go to patients. I want them to know what's going on, and I want them to know the right questions and to demand the type of healthcare that they think is best for themselves.
Well, I think it's all about healthcare consumerism. It's one of my favorite topics because the patient has the power, and so do we as physicians. It doesn't run without us. You know, I mean, the fact that you can make a diagnosis just by in a snap, where other people are going through looking at their iPads and doing their differentials and going through algorithms. I think this, to me, is where this evidence-based medicine really came online, because it has to be cookbook in order for people who are not as well trained to kind of access the system. Even though they may not know what they're doing, they do have some sort of algorithm to follow. It's an expensive one. It may not be right, but they're trying to lead us into this is the standard of care and everybody's a team. And I'm just done with that. I refuse to go down that path. I'm their colleagues, we're collegial, but they should not be running the show by themselves and be able to run to us to fix it when stuff goes south. I mean, maybe we ought to just, you know, withdraw your consent. You guys did. You are independent solo practitioners like I am. And I think in direct primary care, you've removed yourself from the insurance model because it's always somebody telling you what you can and cannot do. Now I'm finding patients are becoming very savvy. They're finding me because they want to know, they want someone who gives a damn, quite frankly, mm-hmm. who'll spend time with them to get them better and not just manage them. So I'm finding a growing number of patients. We need to access that, highlight it, and really empower it. That's how we win this, I think.
Yeah, that's exactly why we wrote the book, for that very reason, because what we're finding and what studies show is that patients are confused. Like you said, because someone walks in with a white coat, they don't know if that's a physician, especially if they introduce themselves as doctor. They could be a doctor of nurse practice, or they could be a PA that earned a doctorate degree. So a lot of times patients, even if they are somewhat educated, they're being misled. So we wrote this book so that patients would know the right questions to ask, or even just have an idea about the difference in training. Mm-hmm. If you turn on the TV, you see, you know, we choose NPs or your PA can. There's a lot of media propaganda out there telling patients that it's okay and maybe even better to choose a non-physician. So we need to give them a different perspective and give them the truth about what the differences are, and so that they can make an educated decision.
I think part of the reason, and Rebecca and I talked about this often, that I'll be honest with you. I've gone to DC. I've worked with various larger organizations, sort of talking with representatives and senators. And after about two trips, I kind of figured it was a lost cause. And it's a lost cause. They don't understand what we're talking about. They don't really care. And the bottom line is, until somebody harms someone that they know that was a non-physician, I don't think that this ball is going to roll that way. So to me, it's always been about patients. And many of the patients in our practice, my practice is 50 years old. I've just recently gotten my first fourth generation patient. My dad would have taken care of the great grandmother as a child, and then everybody after that. And so the patients to me are like my own family, and they're very important. And of course, they're critical to healthcare in general. So I felt like if patients could read the book and then they can decide for themselves, no one's telling them not to see a nurse practitioner, and no one's telling them not to see a PA. There are good professionals out there with experience who have a great high quality education. What we are telling them is not every single, just like not every doctor is amazing. Not every nurse practitioner or PA is amazing. And they need to be savvy consumers, and it's in their best interest to ask what the education is, to ask if a nurse practitioner working independently in an ER has no ER training, the patient has the right to ask that question and have it answered. And so I think for us, what I'm probably most happy with or proud of that's come out of the book is many people are starting to realize, you mean if they say they're a doctor, they're not a physician? And that's probably the whole thing that's turned this entire issue up on its head.
Wow. On that note, let's take our final break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living in Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Al-Ajba. And have I been pronouncing your name wrong? Is it Al-Ajba?
It's Al-Ajba, yeah.
I'm so sorry.
It's fine.
Apologies. And Dr. Bernard. They've written a very timely and important book that everybody needs to go out and get. And they can get it on Amazon.com. Again, it's Patients at Risk, The Rise of Nurse Practitioners and Physician Assistants in Healthcare. And you can also go to their blogs. Dr. Bernard has a blog, RebeccaBernard.com, RebeccaBernard.com. And Dr. Al-Ajba, I know you've been on Kevin MD, you write for thedeductible.com. Do you also have a website with your blogs?
I do, and it's the same like Rebecca. It's www.naran, N-I-R-A-N, and then my last name, A-L-A-G-B-A.com.
Awesome. So I want to get into the money side of this, because this didn't just pop up out of the blue. We know that Congress is totally susceptible to money exchanging hands and doing what their bidding is. But I think that Wall Street and corporate-driven healthcare has also really been, I think, movers and drivers of this system. I can't tell you how many but urgent cares have popped up here in Atlanta. And they literally popped up next to colleagues of mine who have direct primary care to try to put them out of business. So they see this as a money-making venture. And that's the antithesis of healthcare, in my opinion. What do you guys think about that?
I'm so sorry. My dogs just started barking. Sorry. My husband just got home. My apologies. What you're saying is 100% right. The private equity market has been a huge problem for healthcare. It's raising costs. We know that, especially in the field of dermatology, it's become quite lucrative. There are many private equity companies that are hiring non-physician practitioners, and they do biopsies at a much higher rate than physicians do.
I had no idea.
Yeah. And the other thing that's really interesting is you often hear it said, well, you know, these practitioners can provide underserved care. And what we're seeing, though, is an awful lot of cash-based type practices, Botox and fillers and IV vitamins and all sorts of not necessarily underserved work.
I didn't know that either.
That's interesting. The thing is, when you're in an underserved area, I'm in a health professional shortage area. I mean, it's actually shocking, but there are people out there that are in their 30s and 40s that want to see me as their primary care doctor. And I had one today, and one of the local radiologists was teasing me about my 35-year-old patient. And as a pediatrician, you know, I'm sort of out of my scope, which the patient knows, again, and is empowered to make their own decision. But there simply aren't enough physicians to go around. And what's interesting is it's really hard what we do. And I'm not saying that it's harder than others. I've heard specialists sometimes say that what they do over time, they could train anyone to do. And I'm not sure I necessarily agree with that, but I'm not a specialist. But I will tell you, in primary care, I never know what's going to walk through my door. And I've had parents coming in who think their kid has pink eye and they have a retropharyngeal abscess, which is a life-threatening condition. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, every single day I get something that I'm unfamiliar with or have to look up. And it's unbelievable what we have to know and what we have to see. And I've been doing this, you know, an education that was in 11 years. I've been practicing 19, almost 20 years. And I still feel like there's so little that I know. And again, I think when you're out in this area by yourself, I have no pediatric specialists where I am. The specialists here locally won't see anyone under the age of 18. So we are really kind of doing everything you can imagine. And it's something that when you want to say train for 500 hours and then go out and do what I do, it simply can't be done. And if somebody tries, it doesn't go well. And so I think that's the problem is it would almost be better, I think, to have, you asked about solutions. It would almost be better to have non-physician practitioners under the scope or under the guise of a specialty that is more by protocol. There's some great studies that look at follow-up patients in rheumatology, for example. And I'm not picking on rheumatology or saying it's easy at all. What I'm saying is if there was a chronic, stable patient with a certain condition, that the physician felt really comfortable can be followed up every other time by a non-physician practitioner. That's the role. Or we put non-physician practitioners in roles like the Burlington randomized trial, which was primary care physicians who trained their longstanding experienced nurses to do chronic follow-up or chronic follow-up with people who had chronic conditions that were stable. And what ended up happening is that practice, which is in Canada, ended up being able to expand their patient capacity by 22%. So there is a huge role, I think, for non-physician practitioners in healthcare. I think there are not enough of us to go around, but I don't think it's in urgent cares. I don't think it's in emergency rooms, and I don't think it's in specialties where there's no training. So if you're a family nurse practitioner, if you're working in a neurosurgery clinic and there's no protocol or oversight, I think that's concerning. So I just think we need regulation like we have for medicine. I'm not saying I agree with all regulation, but I think we need some.
Well, you know, there is legislation, but often it's confusing and it's not followed. You know, one of the most important cases that we discovered during this that we actually centered our whole book around had to do with a family nurse practitioner who was credentialed and hired to work in an emergency room, not even in a rural area, in a just outside of Oklahoma City. And she was left on her own to take care of the critically ill patients. And of course, she missed a diagnosis and a young woman died because of that. And this is a multi-billion dollar organization. And as you spoke about, as far as money making, this is an organization that chose to save money by hiring nurse practitioners instead of board certified emergency room physicians. And so a person died because of that. And this is happening across the country. So there's no way that they would put a family physician like me to work in an emergency room. I would never be credentialed. But yet a family nurse practitioner, somehow that's considered acceptable. And that's one of the things that's really perplexing. And it's something that really must stop. There are roles and there are places that we all can work in, but we need to know our limitations and patient safety has to come first.
I can't you know, you, what you both said is so powerful. I don't really, it's, people need to listen to that. I mean, the fact that I've been in practice for almost 20 years as well, and it's a practice. That's what medicine is. It's not like you learn it all in your 6 years or 8 years, whatever training it is. You learn every day. And as a specialist, I can't say that it's routine because everybody's different. But the fact that we have a fear, this inkling of, I don't know everything, I better go and read it, I need to continue to get better, that's the thing that makes us different than someone who gets 500 hours. You don't know what you don't know, so you don't even know to be afraid of stuff. That to me is
exactly. Well, that is it. You know, I remember being a third year medical student on OB rotation and seeing a shoulder dystocia where the baby was stuck, and also seeing a placenta previa where the uterus was bleeding like a faucet was turned on. And I remember leaving both of those cases shaking like a leaf and just realizing that if it hadn't been for the skills of those physicians, the baby and the mother would have died. And if all you ever see is just normal, you know, vaginal deliveries that go great and everybody's happy, it would never even occur to you what sort of, in a seconds, life-threatening situations that can occur, much less know how to manage them.
Absolutely agree. And even on the flip side, from a surgeon perspective, just because you're taking like a dermatology situation, just because you're taking off lumps and various things, there's skill associated with that. You hit an artery, you do something that is not so simple, and what do? Who are you going to call? Who do you go to? And the patient is there on the outside looking in. I mean, I'm not sure how. Go ahead.
Well, there just are so many simple ways for things to go wrong. And, you know, I spend a lot of time talking to the residents and med students because I think people come in and they say, well, so what if they do this extra study? I just had a college kid, actually, who had a little bit of bleeding. And I'm just going to say a history that was consistent with just a simple hemorrhoid. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that patient was told they had gastritis, which doesn't make any sense because the stomach is high and you wouldn't have bright red blood from below. You'd have dark blood. And then they went to another so that was by a non-physician. Then they went to another non-physician who in a GI clinic. And that person said, hey, let's do a colonoscopy. This is still a teenager. So what's fascinating to me is it's not without risk. You know, colonoscopies, you can perforate someone's intestine, they can get infected. I know it's not common, but the biggest concern to me is not only that the wrong diagnosis may be made, but that studies or evaluations that could actually harm the patient are going to be done. So if you extrapolate that all forward, this kid could have had a procedure, could have potentially been perforated, potentially gotten sicker for something that you can see on exam, which is a hemorrhoid. To me, it's baffling to do all this medical care that's unnecessary because, again, there's harm with that too. And so we forget that second part of it, which is not only harm by not, you know, diagnosing, like Alexis Ochoa Dawkins, who is the young lady we covered in our book who died of an undiagnosed pulmonary embolus. But at the same time, this was a 19-year-old kid that I just told you about and also in college. And they could have been harmed by too much care. And that's you got to find that sweet spot. And I'll tell you what, I'm still looking for it after 20 years. So how does 500 hours teach someone how to keep patients the safest?
That's the million-dollar question. This show goes so quickly. You know, we have about a minute and a half left. I want to make sure people know how to reach you and read your blogs. And you actually have a podcast as well, don't you?
We do. It has the same name as our book. It's called Patients at Risk. And you can get that anywhere that you listen to podcasts. And we also have a YouTube channel by the same name, Patients at Risk.
And if people want to come to your practices, how can they reach you to become a patient?
I'm quiet here because both of our practices are pretty full. I'm always interested in talking to patients, and I'm also really interested in talking with doctors, especially those that are interested in pursuing direct primary care. And my website of my practice is gulfcoastdpc.com. And I'd also just like to put a quick plug in for our group, Physicians for Patient Protection, for any doctors that are interested in learning more about this and fighting for physician-led care. And that's physiciansforpatientprotection.org.
And for me, my practice is relatively full. I do take second and third and fourth generation patients without question. So I'm always open for families that have been with us for decades. But I, again, if someone really needs my help, I usually try to step up and do what I can. So my practice is Silverdale Pediatrics in Silverdale, Washington. The website is silverdalepediatrics.com. I'm on Twitter at Silverdale Peds, and then Mommy Doc on Facebook. And my website is naranalajba.com.
I really enjoyed our conversation today. I can't wait to have you guys back. I think we just scratched the surface, and there's so much more, honestly, that we can talk about. Even just giving these examples, people, I guess, learn by hearing stories, right?
Yeah.
So I would love to have you both back so that we can go into more detail about cases that you've experienced, that you've written about, because I think that's instructive for people.
Absolutely. I know that I would love to. I'm sure Naran would too.
I'd love to come back.
Awesome. Well, thank you both and Happy New Year. And thank you, everybody, for living in the solution.
Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times. Liberty Talk Events.